Cynthia Stanton Kim, I'm married to Bukyong Kim, who's from Korea. We've been married 45 years. That's right, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm Bukyong Kim. I'm married into England through my wife, Cynthia Kim, in 1970.
Well, let's see.
That's Schaefer married us.
Oh, did he? Did he?
Schaefer married us, yes. He was flying from America to England to see his daughter and then on to Switzerland. And we had to have got all our papers ready, hadn't we? Mm. Of course, you had to get a lot of papers from Korea, one thing and another. But they were all ready, so we said, let's go for it. And we did, and we had to have a civil wedding the day before.
Because our church was house church, which wasn't registered for wedding.
Yes. That's right, yes. And so we had a nice little garden wedding, and Susan Schaefer was wonderful. She made all the sandwiches, I think, and made a very nice little spread for our family and friends.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's begin then with the interview. Cynthia, when did you meet Schaefer? And were you a Christian or were you not at the time?
I think I met him in 1950 when he'd come over to go up to Cambridge. I was a Christian and a friend invited me to one of his talks, his little sitting room talks.
How many people would have been present, do you think?
Maybe about 15, not a great number.
And early on, that was pretty much the case, wasn't it?
Yes, yes, yes. There was a flat we used to meet in, which belonged to Joe Martin's wife, Lynette Martin. Where was that? Anyway, we met there. That was a very tiny, smaller room than this, yes. Mm. And I remember one time when someone brought their enormous dog and it sat right across our legs and listened to the discussion for the whole evening.
Kim, when did you meet Dr. Schaefer?
I went to Swiss Library in 1969 as a student, and that's the first encounter.
Okay. Yes. Were you a Christian at the time?
I was sort of a Christian, yes, yes.
Okay. Are you from South or North Korea?
I'm originally from North Korea. Our family fled to South before Korean War in 1950.
And how did you get to know about Labrie?
Well, I went to Canada to study first, and then I went to Rome to study Roman Catholicism. But an American lady who had been to Swiss Labrie, knowing my intention, and she said to me, before you do anything, go to see Schaefer. So that's how I ended up in Swiss Labrie, and that's the history.
And how long were you there at Labrie at that time?
I was there for 4 months. Mm-hmm. Before we came back to England to get married.
And what stands out in your mind about Schaefer during those days?
Well, he was very much a father figure, a sort of substitute father figure, spiritual as it were, yes. And he was very personal in a relationship, and that attracted me very much. Not only his thinking and his theology, all that.
Mm. Okay. And after you heard Schaefer in Cambridge...
No, I heard him in London.
Yeah, excuse me, in London.
Yes.
Were you impressed, and in a good sense, with what he had to say? And if so, what was it that caught your attention?
Yes. Well, I was a bit alarmed. I wasn't quite sure about him at all. The look of him or the way he was just talking and saying Excellent. Things. And I was with very good friends and we talked about it and we went to hear him several times. And then he started talking about art. Well, art was my subject and I was very interested and I'd never heard Christians talk about art before. In fact, I'd never heard them talk about any of the things that he talked about before. I was typical evangelical convert from the school camps, and very narrow, not expected to look at anything beyond the Bible. And here was this man telling us that the Bible, that Christianity opened the windows to everything, and that excited me, and I felt this was worth following. So I stuck close to them, both of them.
And Kim, for you, did he share anything new? I mean, you'd already been studying. So my question is, did what Schaefer had to say, was it new to you? Not so much the content, but the way he said it. Was it new to you or what?
Yes, very, very new. Obviously, the atmosphere and the way Labrie worked then, it's all because of him and Edith Schaefer. Community was new to me, and that really gave me a new insight into the Christian community. Not only as a church, but as a non-church community, and that's how I faced with this new thing. Not only, as you said, not only the content, but which opened my eyes into the wider truth.
That this idea that Christianity spoke to every area of life.
That's true. Yeah.
Yes.
And any particular, he was obviously thought of as an apologist, though he himself thought of himself as more of a pastor, missionary, evangelist, but he certainly had the reputation of being an apologist. So as you listen to him and his sharing of the gospel, working with people, what stood out in your mind?
When I was there, I didn't realize what all you were talking about, the apologetics or the wider aspect of Labrie. I was right in the middle of it, and when you are in it, you really don't. I just sucked it all up, what's offered there, and kindness and living together closely, mostly Christians. And his approach was very personal, close relationship. I mean, obviously, I didn't know he was that big man, not physically big man, but he was just the little man talking to me as a person to person. And that's why I said he was like, if I felt like he was my father figure, because I didn't have much of my father. So that struck me very much.
And of course, you would have met him after he had been in the States in 65, when he gives the Wheaton Lectures, which really seems to be the point at which the rest of the world, evangelical world, became aware of this person in the mountains, in the Swiss Alps. So he hadn't really become the big man. It was just happening. Now you met him before much of the world knew anything about
yes,
him.
Yes, yes.
And he would come to, he also would come to Cambridge. He went to different places to speak.
Mm.
But apparently the groups were not that large early on.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, yes. The word was that he was a missionary and he came to Cambridge and they lived by faith financially. And he talked to the students there, and that's about it. There were people who listened to him, and people who took him very seriously. And later on, they wanted to go and study with him. They felt that what he was saying was so very important. But he never wanted to write. He wasn't writing there at all. And he certainly didn't want people coming up and asking him questions about everything. That was very difficult. But he did eventually want to write because he said, other people are writing my things, I better write my own things. That's what he said. And he produced the book, Escape from Reason, because that was very prevalent at that time. People were going to India, the Beatles and so on, were going to India and wanting to find out something else. And this is the sort of things he was talking about, and existentialism was wide. And we had them coming in the 1960s, later. In the early time, it was mostly just people who were different ages and different backgrounds and different fields of work and study. But later on, it was a lot of hippies and so on came along and wanted to hear what he had to say.
Now, your background was art?
Yes.
Okay.
I was an art student. I had been an art student, unfortunately. That's not when I met him. I met him when I was teaching. So
Schaefer begins to open people's eyes that Christianity, that art is simply something that human beings create because they're created in the image of God, and art is worth our attention.
Oh, absolutely, yes, yes.
And that we can, for two reasons maybe. One, well, we can learn what the artist is saying,
mm-hmm.
but there's also something to be appreciated in the art itself.
Yes, yes.
So how did that change you? And you're teaching art, so how did that change, if it did?
It didn't change my teaching much, but if it had come earlier, I would have been a painter and not a teacher. Because everyone says, you can't go into art, it's too competitive, or, it's not a very noble thing to go into.
For a Christian.
And the only thing, mind you, I love teaching. I started off by teaching the children as I was taught when they were given big pieces of paper and a subject to paint. And we painted what we saw. And that's what I wanted to do with the children, open their eyes to the nature all the way around them, because that's what my mother had done. She'd taken us up mountains and down mountains and made us look at sunsets and all sorts of things. So, this is what I wanted to do with the children. So I was very happy to teach, but I really, in my heart, wanted to paint because there were painters in the family way back. Mm.
Did you ever do any painting?
Well, I did a little bit. We have one or two things.
Kim, in reflection, how did you think first of all, that Schaefer influenced your life. You've told me, you know, he was sort of the father figure. He mentored you spiritually. Any other ways that you think of as you look back on your life and time with Schaefer?
Yes, it changed the whole my outlook, worldview, and not only theoretically, but my personal, you know, character, my way of life, especially having brought up in a Confucius environment in Korea. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. If you live in it, you just you are Confucius. And that has been changed a lot. I still have a remnant of it in myself, which will come into conflict with the with Cynthia and all that. But that is very important for me to change. As a Korean, as Confucius educated, but coming into Western society, which is largely based on Christian culture, and I've learned a lot, and that's what I, as a Korean, I try to be as much as possible as a Christian, sometimes too much Westerner, but to Korean eyes. And in my ministry, 25 years of Christian ministry for Korean church in London, that's what I try to do. And so I'm a sort of, in their eyes, I'm a black sheep in Korean society. I'm sometimes even called heretics because of the way I do, based on Schaefer's teaching, also not only Labri, but IPC, the church itself. So the things that we do, we try to do, follow what Schaefer thought and did, not only for Labri, but for the church. It's, Korean church is largely based on the teachings of American church, Methodist or Presbyterian or whatnot. But it's culturalized in Korean milieu. We have had a hard time to sort of break that down and rehash with a new thought, biblical or Schaeferism or whatever.
Yeah. I'm assuming you've read some of Schaefer's books.
Yes.
Yes. And out of those books, if I came to you and I said, I don't really know much about Schaefer, but I'd like to start reading, what book do you think you would have me read first?
Well, Labri would be the first and maybe last, if you want to have only one book, yes, because that's what he did, what he stands for, and what went through, good model of our life. Yeah.
Cynthia, you mentioned that the book Escape from Reason that came out just a little bit before The God Who Is There, though it actually was written after. But
really?
InterVarsity had heard those lectures and wanted them.
I see.
And wanted them in print so badly, and they were still working on the Wheaton lectures. So what book do you think that would be today that would be most helpful for somebody to read if they wanted to get at something of Schaefer's ideas?
Well, I think The God Who Is There. I'd give people and make them go through it.
Many people would say the book True Spirituality.
Yes.
And I wonder if you heard him speak on that subject of what comes out in the book as true spirituality And I think that came something, at least it was started with his, what he called his crisis, early on in the early 50s. So did you hear him speak on that at all?
I think I heard all those lectures. On a Tuesday afternoon, when he gave lectures in the down in the sitting room in Lemelaire's, and Joe Martin would record it on a tape recorder for the students, and every Tuesday we heard them. Because he used to give his lectures at the table, and then the doctor said he wasn't to because he got indigestion, so we had to move down to having lectures after the meal, you see. He didn't want to waste any time.
What were they like?
Just grabbing. What can I be? It's become so part of me now, you know, that I can't pick anything out at the moment. But, you know, they were all vital for us. And the wonderful thing is when he gave discussions, I never asked a question. And I never remember asking a question because everyone used to ask the questions that, oh, yes, that's the question I wanted to ask, you know. And he didn't mind what questions you asked, as long as it was a good question that was really from your heart. And he'd answer it, but I was always too shy and nervous to ask a question, so I listened to everybody else's questions. That's how I learned. But what was so amazing is that to have someone sit down and ask questions. I mean, I remember as a student, we used to think, oh, we'll have question time this week, you know, and we'd all say, oh dear, suppose they ask a question we can't answer, you know, something like this. And it never went awfully well, but for someone to do that and be able to talk about so many different things was just amazing. That was one of the amazing things for him.
Did he ask people to ask questions, or did he just engage people that got them asking questions of their own?
He'd ask, are there any questions, you know, but if no one had any questions, somebody had always sent something to him, a paper, and he'd take up, this is what I read, and so let me talk about this, or let's discuss this. You see, so there was always something there. We never lost for anything to discuss, talk about. So.
So those discussions often would center on periodical essays or something that was going on in the news or
yes.
A book.
Uh-huh. Yes. The Time. Well, what is the American magazine? He always got that. Was it the Times? Times? I don't know.
Oh, he reads widely.
Yes, he read widely. So, and people were always sending things to him, and he was always writing, so there was always plenty of material, even though we were stuck away in the mountains.
Did it amaze you that when they started Le Brie, of course you knew him before, and Kim, you knew him after Le Brie started, but one of the things that they agreed upon is that they would never advertise.
Yes, absolutely.
And so did it amaze you that people were coming in such numbers, but just by word of mouth?
Well, since he'd visited Oxford and Cambridge, you see, there were people there who'd heard him and people who wanted to come out. You know, it was at a time when after the war, we Brits were beginning to travel. And so they might go as far as Switzerland, you know. Oh, and in fact, I went on a ski holiday, and that's how I went down to the chalet, because my friend was there, We were a group of Christians, and my friend was there who had introduced me and said, oh, the Shavers live near here. Oh, we'll go down to see them. So we went down to see them, walked down, and there was Edith pouring out lovely little cups of coffee. And I thought, this funny coffee at this time of day. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. They hadn't got up from lunch. They were still talking in a little room, not as big as this. About 10 of them, a German, a Dutch, South African, no, South American, and an American, and a Swiss girl, and us. And she was just serving them, and they were talking.
When he came to America, many in the evangelical world were quite suspicious of him.
Yeah.
And so I'm thinking, you said you come out of kind of a narrow evangelical world. How did the church that you knew about in England, how did they respond to Schaefer?
Oh, in exactly the same way. I went to a conference and there was a reporter sort of just behind us going, you know, pouting all the time. And then apparently it turned, he wrote in the paper that he listened to Schaefer for a while and then he decided to escape from Schaefer. Because they just didn't catch on at all. It was really ridiculous.
Even John Stott didn't welcome him in the beginning.
No, he was very suspicious of him, yes. But now I didn't, I went there after LaBrie had started. I went in 61, I went as a, went there as a helper. Then I became a student, then I became a worker. So I was there through different phases. I missed out on the first 5 years. I wasn't there. So, but it was amazing the way people responded to him. I would have thought he would. They would have welcomed him with open arms. Mm. Really.
Well, in America, maybe not so much in the Presbyterian community, but in the broader, more evangelical, broader evangelical world, of course he had. By the time he comes, he starts having long hair, and oh my. That would just automatically, oh, why, what is he, you know?
Oh, yes, and the knickerbockers.
The knickerbockers, yes.
Climbing, yes. And the way he'd just sit there, he wanted to be just like he was at home, just relaxed and talking and asking questions. He didn't want to put on any face. And he hated, on Saturday nights, sometimes, he just felt, I can't go down and talk any longer. He was so sort of exhausted. I don't know whether this was the beginning of his cancer, but he wasn't a person who liked to stand up and listen to his own voice. It was really genuine. But he went down there and he'd sit and you wouldn't know that he was tired or worried. He'd talk, and they talked. We talked till 2 o'clock in the morning, and we girls would be upstairs preparing the dinner, and we'd rush down and say, look, we've got to send our chocolate down. They need some chocolate, and we'd send some chocolate down, and they talked.
Kim, did you work there at all or stay there for, you said, what, 4 months?
4 months as a student.
As a student.
Yes, and then we came back to England. Mm-hmm. And as soon as we came back, we joined the first English LaBrie in Ealing, in London, where Ranald Macquarie was living and started library and the church there. So we joined them as soon as we came. Actually, we were married in 52 Cleveland Road in Ealing, which is very famous, mentioned in various articles. Yes. Then we moved down here in 1971. Yeah. We got married in 1970, moved down here in 1971, and we started with Ranald when Labrie started here. Ranald and Sue.
Do you think people knew that Schaefer was becoming famous? You know, he starts Labrie in 1955. And in 1960, Time Magazine.
That's what I'm thinking of. Yes.
Had an article, not a large article, but I imagine you think that it shows up in Time Magazine just 5 years after Labrie starts.
Yes.
And no advertising, you know, no broadcasting, didn't have the social media that we have today. And in that, they call him a missionary to the European intellectuals.
Oh.
And so it's quite interesting that within 5 years of starting Labrie, that even somehow an organization like Time Magazine hears about this. And so it seems to me that it wasn't only astounding to Christians what he was saying, it was even astounding to the world.
Yes.
Of what he was saying.
It was just amazing, but he spoke more to the world than he did to the Christians. The Christians were hard to get through to.
So for those of you who, you know, worked closely with Schaefer, and you worked closely with Schaefer and what was going on at Labrie, I've been told that if there were a number of people there at Labrie on a given day, that it wouldn't be unusual for Schaefer to be sitting under a tree somewhere talking to only one individual.
Be unusual?
Was that his kind of his style, to engage an individual that maybe had questions?
And oh, yes. I mean, he'd take them a walk along the Panay Road, or used all the Panay Road. A funny incident. Ranald Macquarie on Sunday, Schaefer wanted to talk to Ranald, he'd take him along the Panay Road and walk, and he'd be wearing his kilt, and the French peasants going by would say, "Bonjour, monsieur, madame." Because he had this kilt on.
Yes.
He was a great walker. He and Edith walked well, and they skied, and they were healthy. And they would talk to people as they were doing things.
Kim, what do you think might have been one of his great gifts, one of his great abilities that you didn't see in maybe other Christians?
Yes, I don't have it in myself. I envy him, and that is that his mind can go into the nooks and crannies of everything which matters to God and hence to us. And that mind is absolutely brilliant. And that helped me to see the way he sees. A very good model.
But you're a good listener, like Schaefer was. Everyone says that. You listen.
For different reasons, because I have nothing to say about the subject, I'm so ignorant. Yeah, that's it.
You had private conversations with Schaefer, I assume.
Not very much.
Okay.
I was just one of, little student. And, yes, I haven't had much conversation. I asked some questions here and there, but, yes, I listened to attentively to what he has to say at the table, lectures, and just absorbed everything that he had to say. Mm.
And it's interesting because, Cynthia, you said this, I was talking to somebody, I forget who, and they had said, at one point they had known Schaefer, been influenced by Schaefer, and they decided they would go back and read one of the books, and I think it was The God Who Was There. And they're reading it and they're thinking, what's so great about this? And then you just realize that they have been so influenced.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes. Yeah.
So influenced by it, it seems
this
striking.
Is normal.
This is normal.
This is normal.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
What do you think that Schaefer, what do you think that what Schaefer said, of all the things he said, what do you think might be one of the most important things for the generation that we're living in now?
Yes. His prophecy, as it were, a negative prophecy that in not so near future, people will be so comfortable and looking after their own interest and comfort, that they would not. Labrie, in fact, will have to disband because people are not interested in big questions. They're so comfortable. They're not. They don't come anymore with the big questions, which we find it here, everywhere, really, in Korea or. I think that was a great
mm-hmm.
insight,
mm-hmm.
Which is not very good. But that was it, yeah. Mm. We're struggling.
I think it's the last episode in How She Would Then Live, personal peace and affluence.
Yes.
Yeah.
He saw that coming, mm-hmm. and of course, we're right in the midst of it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes, we are.
Did you have private conversations, one-on-one conversations with Schaefer?
Not a lot, no.
No. Mm-hmm.
No, I had more. I mean, I was more with Edith Schaefer.
Mm-hmm. So what role does Edith play in all of this?
Well, she is the other side of Schaefer. I mean, we always said they couldn't do without each other in a way. He needed her enormously, and she had an awful lot to give because she was. It's very hard to explain, but there she was.
Well, as they say, behind all great men,
it's a great woman. Yes, she did. She put the picture behind him. I mean,
mm-hmm.
she built something there for him to work within. You see, the home, and the sociability with people. Because he wasn't a great socialite in a way. I mean, he'd say that himself, and he'd forget people's names and say to Edith, oh, what's the name of that person over there, you know? But he'd know all about them, and he'd never forget about you. And she made it possible for him to really operate in a way, although in another way he didn't. He'd just sit down on the campus and start talking to people. That was the wonderful thing, and that was what I think they taught us about evangelism. We didn't have to go and have wave a flag for Jesus. And this is what, you know, he talked about God.
Yes.
God, God is there. And this is what was missing here in England, you know. Everyone was talking about Jesus, and it wasn't helpful. There's no Jesus, there's no, you know, you've got to know the God who is there, and they've got to know. Now it's so wonderful, because you know who you are. You know that you have been conceived, and you can see it in camera, the conception, and that everyone is unique and is made in the image of God, and you see everyone as a person, as somebody precious to God and to us, should be to us. I mean, I think this is what came to life throughout the years when, you know, he was talking and there were new things happening. That beautiful book that Coop.
Yes.
Dr. Coop. Dr. Coop.
Coop, yeah.
Yes.
Coop.
Whatever happened to the human race.
Whatever happened, that was just wonderful.
Mm.
So, yes. What part did prayer play in Schaefer's, in the home life and in Schaefer's ministry?
Well, Ella Bree, they made it a rule to have a whole day prayer day on Monday. We still have it here.
Set aside.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, all over the world, yeah. And that was one of the things that Ella Bree value very highly. I mean, an absolute necessity, not only as a corporate...
We had days of fasting, didn't we, too?
Yeah, yeah. And as an individual, prayer is the absolutely necessary thing to do. Mm. Yeah. Still valued very much in the library. But talking about the relation between Labrie and I mean Edith and Schaefer. Edith aggravated him sometimes, if not more often, and tested his patience. There's an episode of No Trousers episode. Did you hear that?
No.
Can we talk about it?
Sure.
he speaks about it publicly himself.
Yes,
so
yes.
I guess you can.
You want me to tell us?
No, you go ahead. Yeah. Because
I love this story because, particularly when we're dealing with Asian people and the pastors who have to be so straight, and they were in a hotel unpacking up to go, and Edith was behind, and he was ready, and he got his case and he went to the door. He said, "Well, I'm ready." And then he looked down and he hadn't got his trousers on. So, I mean, he tells this story against himself.
Yes.
And I think that's wonderful.
Yes.
And that's wonderful wherever you are. You
yes.
tell that funny story.
Yes.
And he always did. He often did tell that story.
I've heard the story told that at one time they were on their way to airport. So you've heard the story?
Yes.
So tell me, what's the story?
Well, as far as I remember, they were going to the airport, and Edith suddenly discovered she hadn't got her passport.
No. They had a quarrel in the car.
Okay.
And Dr. Schaefer sort of let her out of car, get out of car, stopped and let her out, leaving her in the motorway somewhere. And he went on. Pardon?
She hadn't got her passport.
No, that's later. That comes later.
That comes later.
Yeah. I don't know what the quarrel was about. Anyway, she was left out on the road. And he went on to the airport. And then the story goes that Edith appears in the airport, running to Schaefer, waving passport, here, passport. And they realized that they didn't have passport. Now, what happened was she was waiting. I mean, that she wasn't waiting. I don't know what she was waiting for, but she wasn't waiting. She was there on the road, and suddenly this car stopped in front of her, and there was I don't know who that was, maybe Udo or someone, one of the workers, picked her up. And they said, "What are you doing here?" And she didn't tell them, but he said to her, "Well, you forgot passport." So he was taking the passport to the airport. On the way, she saw Edith on the road, picked her up, and then went to the airport. Edith said, "Here's the passport."
And got there first before he did.
No, Schaefer got there, was there.
Oh, he was there. Yeah.
Found out that he was without passport. Then Edith appears
with a passport.
That's the story.
Oh, I see, sorry.
That's a logical sequence.
Yes.
All right.
It's interesting, as I hear people speak about Schaefer, knew him personally, were in the group where...
Yes.
Schaefer was, that he was not by nature a sociable person.
Oh, no.
But yet something about his love for the Lord and the truth.
Yes.
That overcame all that, didn't it?
Absolutely. Yes. I mean, he was brought up, he was an only child. Yes. And his mother was very strict. Had a very strict mother, and of course his father wasn't there a lot of the time he was in the Navy. So, you know, the Steel Woman had this young boy who was very bright and probably very bouncy, and she kept him, you know, and she kept her house very clean and tidy, and, you know, she was lovely.
Well, as I... At the end here, I would say, what would you want to have people remember about Schaefer as they listen to your conversation today? What is it you would like them to remember about Schaefer? Each one of you can respond to that.
Yes. Well, while you're thinking, the love in the end, he insisted that we have to reflect that love of God that he showed to us in the end. Well, he regretted very much when he split away from the liberals, that he talks about it, the true spirituality. In the end, and love counts no matter what you do, which... I myself lack very much, and in the end, I think that's the last word I think I would like to say to people and show to people myself.
And that was a deep concern of his within the Presbyterian community, that he had seen how they fought with one another, and that disturbed him greatly. And that's when I think he leaves the mission. He has this letter that he writes and says, "I've been on this train too long." And it really did pain him to see how Christians treated other Christians with whom they disagreed. Well, we may disagree, but how do we carry on that disagreement?
Yes.
And it's in one of his books where he says that the hallmark of true Christianity is love and holiness. Those two things. So, Cynthia, what would you want them, would you want people to hear?
Well, I'm just the way he had time for everybody or anybody and was able to speak with them. I mean, that is one very important thing. I mean, that was a start and that was a finish, as it were, that he was able to share so much with so many people. And I don't know, just this whole personality of being able to relate to people in an ordinary, friendly way, and not make them feel uncomfortable. I mean, it's the same when he was on the stage having a debate. He didn't want to crush anyone. I remember he came off one day and said, "I'm not going to do that again," because he knew he could crush this person. And then if you take off the lid, what do you put on? You know, you've got to put somebody, it's something there, and there isn't time, you know. Somebody's just had the lid taken off their thinking, and something's got to happen. And so he didn't like doing those kind of things. He had to be near people where he could be close to them and ask to see them and follow them up.
So his conversation, he was very, I mean, he certainly didn't hide the gospel.
No, no.
But he was so, it appears from what I'm hearing everybody tell me, is that Schaefer, his conversation, even with the unbeliever, was so natural. It didn't seem to be, you know, this is a confrontation.
No.
You know, I'm here on a mission.
That sort of thing, yeah.
Though he was on a mission.
Yes, yes, yes.
But that did not become obvious.
No. Mm. No.
Yeah.
No, never.
Well, we can pray that there'll be more and more people, maybe not like Schaefer in every way, but will have that same spirit about them to be able to share the gospel and to have the insight into what's going on and how does Christianity answer those things, and respecting everybody as a person, even though we might disagree with them.
Would you like to hear something about Edith?
Yes, sure.
Well, she's a great talker. And not a short talker, but a long talker. And she used to say, well, I heard from you, actually, when she was asked to talk, should I give them a 5 minutes talk or 30 minutes talk or 1 hour talk?
I used to drive her to talk in England. When she was in England, I'd drive her. And she said, do you know, they've only given me half an hour to talk to these kids, to these, you know, the high school kids. And she said, what shall I do? Shall I give the 1 hour talk or the 3 hour talk? But she could always adjust her talks. I mean, she said if she talked to business people, she'd bring up the business history, the history of what went on when they were turned out of Switzerland, you know. And if she was talking to mothers, she'd talk to them from a mother's point of view, where, you know, you've got this two-year-old son and he's running around and you've got to get out of Switzerland, things like this. She'd adjust it. She was very good at
that. Toward her end of her life, she came here, that was what?
I can't remember when that was.
About six, 7 years ago. Mm-hmm. She came on a wheelchair, and she was given a chance to give talk to students here. That was, I think, a special anniversary or something.
Was it? Mm.
And Reynold was looking after her, pushing her chair, and Reynold was very concerned that she would go on and on. and in the end, Reynold had to stop her.
Now, Edith, only 10 minutes. Edith, 10 minutes.
Yeah, that was the last time we saw her, actually.
Mm. Yes.
Was it?
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for sharing.
Oh, you're welcome. I don't know.
These... these your personal time with in the Schaefer environment, what it meant to you, and hopefully we continue to give people not just his intellectual, but that people can understand
the human,
the humanness, the human side of Schaefer, which I think we need so desperately today. The truth, but speaking the truth in love.
Yes.
Well, thank you both very much. Mm-hmm.